is on amid deafening Palestinian cries for international action to silence the guns. Most of the 34 people killed in the latest day of airstrikes were in the refugee-packed city of Rafah in southern Gaza. Other areas throughout the besieged enclave were not spared. Three civilians were killed in an airstrike on a home in the Nusayrat refugee camp in central Gaza, and two others were also killed as Israeli jets bombed northern Gaza City. Nearly 34,500 Palestinians have been confirmed to have been killed in this campaign of genocide since October 7th. However, the actual number is believed to be much higher, as thousands are unaccounted for and presumed buried under rubble. Our Gaza correspondent Muti Abu Musaba joined us earlier from the central city of Deir al-Balah for an update.
The barbaric Israeli attacks are still underway, unabated against different parts of Gaza Strip, whereas the Israeli occupation forces intensified their attacks against several areas of Gaza Strip. Here in the central area of Gaza Strip, 9 Palestinian civilians were reportedly killed over the last couple of hours after the Israeli occupation forces targeted and destroyed several residential buildings, basically in a Nusayrat refugee camp. On the other hand, the Palestinian resistance continued their counterattacks against the Israeli occupation forces. Moments ago, the Israeli military announced the killing of 2 additional Israeli soldiers after an Israeli force was lured into a well-planned ambush in Al-Mughraga neighborhood. And when it comes to Gaza City, the Israeli occupation forces also continued their attacks against different neighborhoods inside the city. More residential buildings were destroyed, basically in At-Tufah neighborhood and At-Daraj neighborhood. At least 4 Palestinian civilians were reportedly killed over those successive attacks over the last couple of hours. Moving to the northern part of Gaza Strip, the Israeli warplanes also carried out several relentless airstrikes against Tal al-Za'atar in Jabal refugee camp and As-Sikka Street in the same area, while Beit Lahia and Beit Hanun were under heavy bombardments over the continuous Israeli artillery shelling.
Israeli police forces a clash with protesters calling on the regime to strike a deal with Palestinians for the release of captives held in Gaza. Police used water cannon to disperse protesters that had gathered outside the ruling Likud party's headquarters in Tel Aviv. Protesters also demanding the resignation of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his cabinet, and are calling for early elections. Many of the protesters have been arrested. Netanyahu is under increased pressure as anger mounts over his failure to secure the release of the captives. Palestinian resistance groups took around 250 captives during Operation Al-Aqsa Flood on October 7th. Hamas since then has released over 100 during an earlier ceasefire deal, but says dozens were killed by Israeli bombing and shelling. And a delegation of senior Hamas officials is set to join ceasefire talks in Egypt amid a looming ground invasion of Rafah in southern Gaza by Israeli occupation forces. The Palestinian delegation, led by the Hamas deputy head Khalil Al-Haya, is expected to submit the movement's response to the latest Israeli proposal. Hamas insists on the withdrawal of all Israeli forces from Gaza, unrestricted return of displaced Palestinians to their homes, and flow of humanitarian aid. The movement will reject any deal that does not include an end to Israel's aggression. The Israeli proposal reportedly seeks to release nearly 130 captives and, quote, restoration of sustainable calm. Meanwhile, the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, who's in Saudi Arabia on the first leg of his Middle East tour, says he's optimistic that a ceasefire will be reached. Also speaking in Riyadh, the British Foreign Secretary David Cameron hopes Hamas will accept the Israeli offer of a 40-day ceasefire in exchange for the release of the captives. The Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah and Israeli military continue to exchange fire along the southern Lebanese border over the regime's war on the Gaza Strip. Our Beirut correspondent Mariam Saleh has your latest.
Well, the latest statement that we have is from Hezbollah's resistance movement. They said that in retaliation for the Israeli aggressions against Lebanese civilian southern villages, and they call them the steadfast villages of South Lebanon, especially the civilian houses in the towns of Khiyam and Shaba, Hezbollah launched a very significant operation. They targeted three different residents in the settlement of Motili using guided anti-armor missiles, and we knew this from the Israelis that there were anti-armor missiles that were targeted that area. We know from Hezbollah now that they confirmed that they have directly hit three residents in that settlement specifically. As you know, those residents have been completely evacuated. Even those settlers that remain in the remote parts of the Galilee region, they are also armed and are also reservists within the army. And so therefore, the entire area has transformed completely into a military zone. Hezbollah has very openly targeted that area, saying they have targeted only military personnel. That was in retaliation for several attacks.
The Israeli regime is increasingly concerned the International Criminal Court may issue arrest warrants against its top officials over war crimes in Gaza. Israeli Foreign Minister said he's notified political and military officials, including Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. International tribunals launched an independent probe into Israel's aggression against Gaza and the occupied West Bank since 2014. Now this amid international pressure mounting over the regime's genocidal campaign on Gaza. Meanwhile, a Geneva-based rights group has condemned Tel Aviv and its allies for trying to prevent the ICC from issuing the arrest warrants. Pro-Palestinian student protesters at Columbia University have vowed to defy an ultimatum that demands they either disperse or face suspension. They say they will not budge, though, until the school meets their demands.
This is not a matter of simply violating university rules. This is a movement, an anti-war movement. We have sparked similar Gaza solidarity encampments across the nation and even across the globe.
These repulsive scare tactics mean nothing compared to the deaths of over 34,000 Palestinians. We will not move until Colombia meets our demands or they are moved by force. Colombia's threat to mass suspend, evict, or possibly expel students with only a few hours' notice violates university rules.
Authorities at Columbia and New York say they started suspending students who refuse to clear their encampment. Earlier, the university said it will not divest financial holdings linked to Israel, which is a key demand of the demonstrators. Columbia University has been at the epicenter of protests that have swept U.S. campuses from coast to coast for almost 2 weeks now. Police in riot gear heavily clamped down on students. Number of arrests at campuses nationwide is approaching 1,000. Large-scale protests on university grounds have spilled over to other campuses worldwide as well, including France, Italy, the UK, Canada, and Australia. A presidential election candidate in the U.S. says that while she was at Washington University's pro-Palestine rally in St. Louis, police arrested her violently and injured her so badly she had to be rushed to the emergency room for a possible rib fracture. Green Party candidate Jill Stein says the police handcuffed and detained her for hours.
It was kind of scary, to tell you the truth, because I got separated from the rest of the crowd, you know, and it initially felt like there was a lot of safety in numbers, but then it turned out that I was being charged with assault after being assaulted by a bicycle and basically thrown onto my head backwards. I was charged with assault, assaulting a police officer. Can you believe it? And so I got separated out, and I was alone going through this whole other process where I was going through a medical exam. I had, regular steel handcuffs put on and sat a long time sitting alone in a cell, and I had no idea. Did anybody even know I was there? I had been separated from my team. And You know, was I going to be there all night? Was I going to be there for a week? You know, what's going on? When could I call my lawyer? So we basically have an expanding war right now. And Netanyahu has been given a license, essentially, to be the commander-in-chief because he's been assured that he will be backed. The U.S. is continuing to shower him with basically a blank check and unlimited amounts of money, and he's trying to embroil us in a war with Iran. This is absolutely outrageous. It is a betrayal of the responsibility of the president to be passing the baton to Bibi Netanyahu, who is not accountable in any way to American voters, and he's making critical life and death decisions for even American troops by the tens of thousands who are, you know, in the Middle East right now, who are being made vulnerable by all of this. The American public opposes the genocide, wants an immediate ceasefire and a diplomatic solution. So we want to get that on the ballot. You know, we want a pro-worker campaign to be on the ballot. We want an anti-war campaign and a climate emergency campaign. We are the only campaign that actually represents all of those issues. So we have a lot to fight for to enable the American people to have a choice, and the American people are clamoring for a choice.
Yemeni Army says it's carried out fresh operations against U.S. and Israeli-linked vessels. Spokesperson for Yemeni Armed Forces said a number of drones targeted two American warships in the Red Sea, said the operations achieved their goals successfully. Yahya Sari said at least two other military operations were carried out against Israeli-linked ships as well. Joint operation by Yemeni naval and missile forces targeted a ship that was stealthily headed to the Israeli port of Umm al-Rashrash or Eilat. Other ship was hit with a number of drones in the Indian Ocean. Sari said Army will continue its operations in response to attacks by the U.S. and U.K. on Yemen and in solidarity with Gazans. Election fever has gripped Indian-controlled Kashmir as the region is set to vote in the world's biggest election. As Sayed Ali Safi reports, political parties are seeking a vote to fight for restoration of the region's democratic and constitutional rights.
Jubilant supporters of Sayed Ruhollah Mehdi thronged the streets, waving party flags and chanting slogans as they accompanied their leader to file his nomination for India's general elections. Mehdi, a former lawmaker and a senior member of Kashmir's oldest political party, National Conference, is a popular political figure in the region who is trying his luck from the prestigious Central Kashmir parliamentary seat. For the people of Kashmir, the elections are most significant as the region will vote for the first time after the revocation of Kashmir's special status by India's ruling Bharatiya Janata Party. In Central Kashmir's parliamentary segment, 29 candidates are in the fray, but the main battle is between two political arch rivals, National Conference and People's Democratic Party. Both the parties are largely fighting the elections for restoration of Kashmir's statehood and semi-autonomy. Ever since New Delhi abolished Kashmir's special status, Mehdi has been strongly opposing the move, calling it undemocratic and unconstitutional.
For this election is being contested to convey the message to Parliament and through Parliament the entire nation of India that the decisions that were taken on August 5, 2019 were taken against the will and the wishes of the people of Kashmir. And all the constitutional norms were violated. We want our dignity to be returned, our democratic rights to be returned, and constitutional status to be restored.
Like Mehdi, his opponent, People's Democratic Party's candidate, and yet another energetic and young political figure, Wahidur Rahman Para, wants people to vote to convey a message to New Delhi that people of Kashmir are not happy.
I think this election is in Kashmir is about hope. People should feel that they are entitled to their rights so that, you know, whatever has been snatched from us, from our rights to constitution, to democracy, to civil liberties, so that we reclaim that space. The only way to restore everything that we lost is through vote, through electoral participation.
Pertinently, Kashmir has been without an elected government for the last 5 years. Para sees India's general elections as an opportunity to break what he calls the cycle of silence in Kashmir.
Srinagar parliamentary segment has historically witnessed abysmal voter turnout. But with Mehdi and Para in the fray, the political observers believe the contest will be very tight. And this time around, The turnout is expected to be unprecedented. Saidari Safi, Indian administered Kashmir.
The sixth edition of an exhibition that is Iran's export potential is dubbed Iran Expo 2024 is underway in the capital, Tehran. Yusuf Mishahmadi takes us there.
Iran's annual business matching fair underway in Tehran. Over 2,000 investors and business people from 120 countries are making the best of the opportunities provided by the sixth exhibition of Iran's export potentials, also called Iran Expo 2024.
I am grateful for the opportunity to learn more about the Islamic Republic of Iran and the potential for joint business projects. I hope that we can find ways to expand our business and trade relations.
The international event has seen a surge in the number of participants compared to the previous years as it upholds the slogan of the year, Surge in Production Through People's Participation. And in line with that slogan, Iran's free trade zones are offering investment incentives for foreign venture capitalists and entrepreneurs.
We offer great investment opportunities, and I wouldn't be exaggerating to say that Chabahar is considered a haven for investors, as they are exempt from routine taxation and other customary charges. This will significantly reduce production expenses and the final price, and therefore increases profit. There are also other incentives for foreign investors, which is why I suggest they pay us a visit.
Iran has 6 free trade zones and 16 special economic zones specifically set up to support economic activities and facilitate international trade relations and offer attractive guarantees and protections to foreign investors.
According to the most recent evaluation of free trade zones in Iran, Aras has received the highest score in all categories. We've been able to increase production and sign new investment contracts with foreign businesses, and we are planning to offer even more incentives to those who wish to do business with us.
Iran Expo 2024 is the largest and most important commercial event in the country. It kicked off on April 27th with companies showcasing their latest products and services in different sectors, including industry, agriculture, tourism, and medical equipment.
The week-long event is a great opportunity for investors and business people to familiarize themselves with Iran's potentials in different economic sectors. Yusuf Mishahmadi, Tehran.
That's it for your latest here, everyone. Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure. IRIB English Radio.
For the past 6 months, the Zionist regime has been laying waste to Gaza. Everything that families invested in is being annihilated. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, the Tuta family had spent a fortune on setting up a pharmacy in Gaza City. It has been in business little more than 2 years when the Zionist regime launched the current genocidal war. When Israel ordered a mass evacuation from the northern part of Gaza on October 13th, the family had no option than to leave. Al-Zaytun, the neighborhood which the pharmacy was located, had been subjected to extreme Israeli regime violence during previous attacks on Gaza. They went to stay with a relative in Khan Yunis, southern Gaza. Back in their pharmacy, they left medical supplies, estimated at $90,000. From those stocks, they just took some blood pressure medication for Fatima, the mother of the family. They stayed with their relatives for more than 50 days. Then, they were uprooted again, this time taking shelter at the European Gaza Hospital near Khan Yunis. They were still at the hospital in late February when they heard of a major Israeli regime offensive against Al-Zaytun. It took a number of days before they learned the terrible news about what happened to the pharmacy. After repeated attempts, Momen Tuta, one of several pharmacies in the family, was able to contact his friend Azam. Azam went to check on the pharmacy and informed Momen that it was completely destroyed. Azam said everything was gone. It was all burnt out. The family had taken an enormous risk to open the pharmacy in the first place. As well as borrowing money, they sold the 350 square meters piece of land which they owned. All of the family were involved in the business. The siblings, who were not qualified pharmacies, helped with such tasks as marketing via social media and delivering supplies. Before they opened the pharmacy, the family had been in a precarious situation. Fatima was supposed to take medication every day, but she could not afford to. When the family incurred debt to put the children through university, Fatima took less medicine than the prescribed dose so that she could save some money. Of Momen's first thoughts on hearing that the pharmacy had been destroyed was that his mother would no longer have enough medicine. Their story is far from exceptional. For the past 6 months, the Zionist regime has been laying waste to Gaza. Everything that families invested in is being annihilated. According to Press TV, the Zionist regime's relentless aggression against the Gaza Strip has now stretched over 6 months and shows no sign of abating, despite international calls for a ceasefire. The Zionist regime launched the war on Gaza on October 7th after the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas waged the surprise operation Al-Aqsa Storm against the occupying entity in response to the Israeli regime's decades-long campaign of violence against Palestinians. At that time, the Israeli regime said attacking Gaza had two goals: eliminating Hamas and bringing back the hostages taken by the resistance group to Gaza. None of them have been achieved so far. About 130 of the 250 Israeli captives taken during Al-Aqsa Storm are still in Gaza after a provisional truce deal in December saw the exchange of a number of prisoners between the two sides. The conflict in Gaza has taken a devastating toll on Palestinians, with over 33,200 people, including 13,800 children, having lost their lives in 180 days of war, according to the Gaza Ministry of Health. On top of that, around 76,000 people have been wounded, about 4 out of every 100 people in Gaza. The Palestine Red Crescent Society said recently some 1,000 children in Gaza have lost one or both of their legs. A record-breaking 176 UN staff members and 6 foreign aid workers have been killed in Gaza since October 7th. The Israeli regime army has killed the largest number of journalists of any modern conflict, and abducted more than 24. More than 140 journalists have been killed during the 6 months of the war in the Israeli regime's military raids, bombardments, and missile attacks across the Gaza Strip. The humanitarian situation in Gaza has worsened day by day as the Israeli regime army continues to prevent aid from reaching the region, resulting in starvation being utilized as a tactic of warfare, as over a million are at risk of starvation, with international groups warning of an imminent famine. At least 27 Palestinians have already died from malnutrition and dehydration, according to international NGOs. More than 80% of Gaza's population, over 1.9 million Palestinians, have been intentionally displaced as the Zionist regime military ordered Palestinians to go south from the start of the war. Some 1.4 million people are believed to be sheltering in Rafah, a small city on Gaza's southern border with Egypt, which is being bombarded by the Israeli forces every day as they have left no safe zone for the Palestinians to live. The estimated $18.5 billion in damage has affected public service infrastructure, resulting in 26 million tons of debris and rubble. Over 290,000 housing units, equivalent to 62% of all homes in Gaza, have been damaged or destroyed by the war, leaving more than a million people homeless. Only a fraction of hospitals, 10 out of 36, are operational following severe damage, leading to overwhelming strain under limited resources. Ashifa Hospital, the largest medical facility in Gaza, has been left severely damaged and burnt after enduring a relentless two-week-long siege. The compound, which witnessed the loss of at least 400 lives and the arrest of hundreds, now faces a dire situation. With an acute shortage of medicine and healthcare professionals on the brink of exhaustion and starvation, the majority of patients in Gaza are unable to receive the treatment they desperately need. The scarcity of resources has forced medical teams to carry out operations and amputations without the availability of anesthetics, further exacerbating the already dire circumstances. On March 6, South Africa filed an urgent request with the International Court of Justice and requested for additional provisional measures issued on January 26. In January, the ICJ ordered the Zionist regime to refrain from any acts that could fall under the Genocide Convention and ensure its troops commit no genocidal acts against the Palestinians in Gaza. Israel described the genocide allegation as baseless. Recently, the United Nations Human Rights Council adopted a resolution calling for a halt to all arms sales to Israel and for the regime to be held accountable for possible war crimes in the Gaza Strip. Moreover, the UN Security Council adopted a resolution last month demanding an immediate ceasefire for the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. The resolution is the first to be approved by the Council after three previous attempts during the past 5 months of war were vetoed by the US regime. Meanwhile, during the month of war, protests around the world have been held in support of Palestine, calling for an immediate ceasefire and halt to arms sales to the Zionist regime.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
With the presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Well, welcome to another episode of the program Viewpoints. I'm Atal, the host of this program. With me in the studio, we have two special guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Rouhani and Sayyid Zain. Sayyid Zain, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
All right, for today's discussion, we want to talk about the significance of mental health and how does the religion of Islam and Islamic teachings help us to achieve mental health more in our Islamic life. As well, Sheikh Rouhani, let's start with you, brother. So all in all, when we take a look Islamically at life, I mean, this type of tawhidi or muwahhid type of look, which is very much away from self-centric world or self-centrism in the modern world, automatically brings a kind of calmness and tranquility into your lifestyle, because all in all you're looking after is the satisfaction of not yourself or the people around, but Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Isn't it, Sayyid?
Yes. So definitely the Tawhidi way of looking at the world, it brings this tranquility, which the modern way doesn't have. Because in the modern way of looking at the world, it's you versus the world, right? Mm-hmm. You're trying to gain as much as you can for your own benefit. And the modern man is making more and more tools to be able to conquer nature, to take more resources from it, to benefit, to have more pleasure in it. So this idea of me against the world is there in the modern way of looking at things. Whereas in the Islamic way of looking at things, it's not like that. It's me in the world that is controlled by higher power, mm-hmm. right? I'm a part of it. I am not against it. Mm-hmm. I'm not, there is a higher power who is there, who is, you know, taking care of things, right? So when someone believes in this and accepts this and accepts that there is a unity in the universe.
Yes.
Right. And there's a system that is there, and you know, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is there, and does dhikr of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, remembers Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and has, you know, reliance upon Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, this automatically brings, you know, calmness.
Calmness.
That I'm worried about, you know, what is going to happen, you know, how will this thing turn out, mm-hmm. right? And if you don't believe in a higher power, okay, then, you know, that worry stays there.
Yes.
Then you try to do your best, and, you know, even then, sometimes things don't go well. So there's a stress, there's anxiety. Mm-hmm. But as soon as you believe in a higher power, you look at it this way. You say that, I'm going to try my best.
Yes.
Right? But at the end of the day, whatever Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants will happen. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, I trust in Him.
Yes. Right?
And that brings calmness and tranquility.
That's right. So does mere, for example, salat and saum and recitation of the Holy Quran brings about mental health? I mean, mere reading or, for example, recitation of du'as and supplications, does it bring mental health or well-being?
For sure. I mean, there's one way of looking at it, which, you know, some people look at it this way, and these kind of benefits are there too, mm-hmm. right? For example, regarding fasting, so the month of Ramadan, we are told and we see the benefits to our physical bodies as well,
yes.
right? And similarly, praying when you're, you know, standing and you're concentrating on, you know, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, what you're saying, that naturally brings, you know, detaches you from all these disturbances, all this multiplicity, and brings you, you concentrate on one thing, brings more peace and calm. Okay. Same thing with, you know, listening to the Quran, reciting the Quran in a nice voice,
okay.
brings this peacefulness and calmness. But this is, I believe, like a lower level of mental health, mm-hmm. right?
That's right.
Whereas, you know, the benefits of these ibadat, these, you know, worships, reciting the Quran and du'as,
yes.
And the benefits to mental health at a spiritual level are even higher.
Mm-hmm.
Where a person, because they're connected to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, they're closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala,
yes.
they rely on Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala,
mm-hmm.
Nothing, they realize that nothing can happen without Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala's say, without His power, outside of His power, then even when things are going very wrong, right, when the stressful events happen
okay.
in their life, they're able to go through it a lot easier because they have this backing. Mm-hmm. Right, one of my teachers he would say that a believer who has worked upon himself and purified himself is like an ocean compared to a person who's not like that, mm-hmm. and he's like a pond.
Yes.
That if you throw a small pebble in a pond, it makes waves,
mm-hmm.
right? But you throw a boulder in the ocean, it makes no difference to the ocean.
Okay.
So a believer, because of purifying himself, he has, you know, made his existence basically yes. higher and greater, mm-hmm. so that he can deal with a lot of problems a lot okay. easier, and therefore have healthier,
yes.
better mental health mm-hmm. as well.
That's all right. Again, Shaykh, we have this concept of psychotherapy nowadays in the Western world. You know, one-to-one counseling, you know, sitting down with a counselor, or we can say a therapist, or therapy, which are providing a safe, confidential, and a structured, a space to talk through all the problems that you have and identify issues a person might have in his life. Do you think that, for example, establishing offices with the presence of the experts who use Quran, Ahadith, or something like that can help the people? Because, all in all, it is an expertise. It is a profession, isn't it? For example, I cannot go to my parents who does not have any knowledge about therapy or something like that and ask them about a special solution to my mental illness, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. But the problem is that in non-Islamic societies, sometimes you have these therapists or...
I'm talking about the Islamic side now.
Muslims might refer to these therapists who are non-Muslims,
Okay.
Their pieces of advice is sometimes dangerous.
Okay.
Harmful. Mm-hmm. It never helps Muslims, because I have had myself some cases that some people, called me that saying that we refer to some of these doctors, we can say,
therapists.
Specialists, therapists.
Yes.
For example, in their own family life, their spouses, they have problems with each other. They said that this therapist told us that for a while, for both of you, try to have, for example, connection with, can I mention it here
a
or not?
Stranger,
with
a
stranger,
sex.
Yeah. Be in contact with strangers for a while, then the problems will be solved. These kind of solutions that sometimes they provide us, particularly Muslims.
Are non-Islamic, I know.
Yeah, it can never help Muslims, okay? This is the point that
I wanted to make. But do you believe we have such terms like Islamic psychology or Muslim psychologists or something like that?
Psychology is a modern science, It's a modern field of study. By this kind of, characteristics that now we have a kind of modern field of study, which is called psychology, we may not find such a thing in Islam, because they define human being, they define the existence or body or mentality or brain, all these different part of our existence in their own way, based on their own, knowledge, on their own fundamental kind of principles. Epistemologically, philosophically, I mean. So that's why we have lots of problems with those bases, with those basics.
Yes.
That is why I think, of course, if it comes to the Islamic kind of solutions to these sort of problems, we have many ayat, many riwayat, many ahadiths, many great scholars, ulama, who have had lots of nice experiences solving these sort of problems. I think one can gather all these things.
Mm-hmm.
One can refer to these kind of scholars and ulama. How can I, for example, solve this sort of problem? There are afkar. There are adaya.
Okay.
There are fasting. There are special kind of prayers, salat.
Recommended actions.
Yeah, lots of recommendations are there. Lots of recommended things there that can help you a lot. Because Islamically talking, sometimes... The word, the term Allah, if you repeatedly pronounce
Allah,
and utter this word during the day, then you feel that it has its own impact on you.
Mm-hmm.
But how can we explain it to the modern therapist?
Yes.
Yeah? They may say that it's nonsense. But we can experience just one day, or for example, for 40 days in early morning, recite Ziyara Ashura. And see what will happen to you.
Mm-hmm.
Just try to experience,
These
sort of things, or for example, some of azkar, beautiful azkar are there that you can just repeatedly always try to repeatedly say this azkar. Then see how much comfortability or comfort or kind of tranquility, peace will come to you,
And this is what the modern human being is really after.
Yeah, we lack
peace,
We lack these kind of things in modern life,
Yes, unfortunately, we said, in this hectic, fast-speed world, with all these noises around, the people are after, they go to the therapist, one-to-one talking to a person who, in most of the ideas, he or she herself, himself or herself, is full of problems, You have to bring your problems to a person who can answer you, Who better than Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala?
Right. There is a place for people as well.
Yes.
Right? Because we do need advice from people.
As
the Sheikh also mentioned, that they cannot be people who are coming from a background that is opposed to the Islamic way of looking at things.
Mm-hmm.
Because then their advice will be incomplete advice.
Yes,
they might say some things that are useful.
And sometimes destructive.
Especially to our souls.
Yes.
And to our bodies and relationships as well. So they might say, some things sometimes that are useful, and we can take those things, but then bring them within our own framework and our own way of looking at the world, at the Islamic way of looking at the world. But there is a place of, scholars especially, right, that sometimes, problems come up for us that we do need advice as well from people. And who should we go to? We should go to scholars,
uh-huh.
People who are well-versed in Islam, who know the teachings of Islam, and who can provide, based on our specific difficulties, the advice that we need, inshallah.
Yes.
So, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, we do ask him for help, but mm-hmm. the intermediaries,
yes.
they're also important that we do.
But we got another problem, inside also the religion of Islam, there are so many schools of thoughts. All of them has their own prescriptions, unfortunately, for the people. I mean,
what we recommend is the school of Ahl al-Bayt.
Okay, very good. Yes, this is the one.
That's it, yeah.
For example, recently I saw footage of these Muslims who try to, and really people make fun of them, just through circular dancing or something like that with the hitting the feet or there are some of these fake mystical movements and approaches.
Strange inside. Kind of meditation sometimes.
Meditations, yes. So they try to bring a kind of tranquility to themselves and says, this wajd and surur that we are making brings a kind of peace. I mean, this pleasure, this joy, brings a kind of peace to us. These are, again, the fake ones, I think. They're not the true type of joy inside, Sayyid Zain, Shaykh Rouhani. That's all right. Okay, thank you very much for a nice elaboration regarding the concept of mental health and how Islam can help us to achieve better mental health in our Islamic lifestyle. It was very kind of you. Thank you very much, Sheikh Rouhani.
You're welcome.
And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Viewpoints. For more information on this program and other programs, visit our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all and fi amanallah. We'll be right back.
follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish. Amid heightened regional tensions and shifting alliances, Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi's first official visit to Pakistan recently was historic and opened a new chapter in Iran-Pakistan ties. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Press TV wrote, "The significance of the visit is best illustrated by veiled warnings issued by the United States to Pakistan, warning against trade dealings with Iran and threatening potential sanctions. The three-day landmark visit concluded with the two countries, Iran and Pakistan, announcing plans to raise the volume of trade between them to $10 billion per year over the next 5 years, up from the current $2 billion. Many documents of cooperation were inked by the two sides in the presence of President Raisi and Pakistani Prime Minister Shahbaz Sharif in the areas of trade, science and technology, agriculture, health, culture, as well as legal and judicial affairs. The key objective of the visit from Iran's perspective was to strengthen economic ties with Pakistan through discussions on economic, commercial, energy, and border cooperation, in line with the Raisi government's game-changing neighborhood first policy." From the Pakistani perspective, the visit provided an opportunity for Islamabad to expand cooperation with Tehran in areas of common interest and resolve all misunderstandings. The visit was particularly seen as an attempt by the two Muslim-majority neighboring countries to mend fences following the missile launches from both sides in January. Sayed Ali, a financial analyst based in Pakistan, told the Press TV website that the visit was significant as it came months after cross-border attacks on terrorist camps, making it crucial for restoring normalcy between the nations. Importantly, the Iranian president's visit to Pakistan was announced soon after the top diplomats of the two countries held talks to allay the concerns of each other arising from the missile strikes. The visit furthered Pakistan and Iran's efforts to reduce tensions and strengthen security cooperation. They pledged to combat terrorism within their borders and establish a system of ministerial-level consultations to oversee progress across multiple sectors. Khawaja Borhan, a journalist and analyst based in Karachi, echoed this sentiment, describing the visit as a breath of fresh air amidst tensions fueled by the ongoing West Asia conflict. Despite Western saber-rattling, he emphasized the potential benefits of completing ambitious projects such as the gas pipeline and free trade agreement and asserted that both nations could greatly benefit if they capitalize on the current momentum for cooperation. The U.S. Department of State recently warned the Pakistani government against dealing with Iran. In a news briefing, spokesperson Vedant Patel referred to the potential risk in engaging with Iran. He said, "We advise anyone considering business deals with Iran to be aware of the potential risk of sanctions. But ultimately, the government of Pakistan can speak to their own foreign policy pursuits." Patel also discussed a U.S. move recently to sanction three Chinese and one Belarusian firms for allegedly selling missile parts to Pakistan. He claimed the sanctions were made because these were entities that were proliferators of weapons of mass destruction and because of the means of their delivery. However, Pakistan's foreign minister stated that the two nations reached an agreement to collaborate in the energy domain, encompassing electricity trade, power transmission infrastructure, and the Iran-Pakistan gas pipeline project. The gas pipeline project has been stalled for over 10 years due to political instability and global sanctions. The pipeline was initially planned to expand over 1,900 kilometers from Iran's South Pars gas field to Pakistan, aiming to fulfill Pakistan's increasing energy demands. Last month, Pakistani authorities signaled their intention to request a waiver from the U.S. for the pipeline's construction on its soil, while rejecting American opposition to the project. Analyst Mohammad Faisal said the threat of sanctions from the United States is primarily aimed at deterring Pakistan and raising the cost of engaging with Iran. He added that the progress of formal trade and banking transactions between the two countries will likely be slow as Pakistani banks hesitate to directly engage with Iranian counterparts. President Raisi said strengthening cooperation between the two sides as two important Muslim countries in the region can play an effective role in solving regional problems. He hastened to add that the presence of foreigners in the region only compounds problems, referring to the United States and its allies. Praising the people and government of Pakistan and their firm stance against the Zionist regime, President Raisi said the two countries have a common stance on the Palestinian issue. The Iranian president also warned that an Israeli attack on Iranian soil would result in a drastic change in the situation, including the complete dissolution of the Zionist regime. During the meetings, both Islamabad and Tehran strongly condemned the Israeli regime's escalating aggression against Palestinians. They condemned the devastating humanitarian consequences of the Gaza genocide, including mounting casualties and the displacement of millions. The two countries demanded an immediate ceasefire, unhindered humanitarian access to Gaza, the repatriation of displaced Palestinians, and justice for Israeli war crimes. They emphasized their support for a just, comprehensive and long-term resolution that aligns with Palestinian aspirations and a struggle against Israeli occupation. President Raisi urged all Muslim countries to forge unity, saying Israel is committing crimes against the oppressed people of Palestine due to a lack of unity and solidarity among Muslim nations. He told the gathering of elites in Islamabad, "What is more lamentable is that the United States, the UK, and Western countries support these atrocities, and the international organizations who claim to defend human rights have lost their efficiencies to stop these crimes. Pakistani Prime Minister, for his part, hailed Iran's steadfastness in supporting the liberation of Al-Quds and defending the oppressed Palestinian people from the Israeli occupation. Unity and coherence among Muslim countries will be the most important element to deter Israel from committing crimes against the Palestinian people, he asserted. The visit came as the death toll in the besieged Gaza Strip has topped 34,000 since the events of October 7th, more than 70% of them women and children. President Raisi's tour to Pakistan, apart from high-level meetings in Islamabad with President Asif Ali Zardari and Prime Minister Shahbaz Sharif, included a visit to Lahore in Punjab and Karachi in Sindh provinces of Pakistan, where he received receptions. Both cities declared holidays to minimize public disruption, and educational institutes remained closed, with a drone ban enforced in Karachi from April 22nd to April 28 by the Sindh government. In Lahore, President Raisi met Punjab Chief Minister Maryam Nawaz and Governor Baligh-ur Rahman, focusing on cultural exchanges. He also visited Allama Iqbal's mausoleum in Sialkot, showing his affinity with Pakistani people and culture, and delivered a lecture at Lahore University. In Karachi, banners with welcome messages by President Asif Ali Zardari and Prime Minister Shahbaz Sharif for the Iranian president were put up on the city's main artery, Sharia Faisal. President Raisi discussed economic opportunities with senior authorities in the port city, vowing to enhance technological exchanges and remove trade barriers between Iran and Pakistan.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Israel's unrelenting airstrikes and artillery fire kill more civilians across Gaza as death toll of regime genocide tops 34,480. Pro-Palestine students at New York's Columbia University defy an ultimatum by university officials to disperse or face immediate suspension. And the Yemeni army says it's targeted two Israel-linked vessels and two U.S. destroyers in the Red Sea and Indian Ocean with drones and missiles.